Notes from the Left Forum in New York City. Rage, rebellion, organizing our power was the theme of the conference where panelists discussed revolutionary alternatives to contemporary capitalism. Dr. Jill Stein, Green Party presidential candidate, took part in a panel on climate justice, carbon markets versus energy democracy. Dr. Stein says it's important to examine the politics of fear, which tell you to vote against what you are afraid of instead of for what you believe in. Stein begins her talk by saying she regards what she is doing in many ways as administering political therapy and helping people break up with an abusive relationship.
An abusive political relationship that hasn't gotten us where it promises and makes all kinds of excuses, and then people start making excuses for their political abuser. But for reasons, I think, that bring us to this room, it's really important to rethink this relationship and what it is that we need in order to even survive, let alone thrive. So I want to say just a few words about the climate crisis and where it stands today, which is very different from where it stood even a year ago. How that reflects on what we can do under this current free market system that is accelerating, actually, in the wrong direction. So I'll say a few words about that, and then I want to talk very briefly about sort of how we could do this. What is the emergency program that it would take to scale up in order to meet this emergency? So you may be well aware that every month in this year now has set a new all-time high record for that month in terms of temperature. We're seeing not only this apocalyptic fire in Alberta, Canada, which, to put it mildly, is unbelievably ironic that there in tar sands country, where one of the largest assaults on the climate is taking place, climate change is coming back with a vengeance, as if Mother Earth were rousing to say, you can't do this, you know, you've got to stop. We have the new heat waves in India that you may have heard about, with temperatures in the 120s, and that's just the heat temperature. I haven't heard what the humidity is, because when you have humidity on top of heat, it makes the effective temperature then actually much higher. And they say it's like opening a hot oven just to sort of be in the air there. And this is going to be the average heat wave in the climate that we are going to. About 2 weeks ago, there was an announcement made by a senior scientist of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And this announcement was made at a national conference of insurance agencies, and it was not widely covered. It was covered in their professional journal online and maybe one other place. But what NOAA announced at that conference was that they had just received an oh my God report from the Antarctic, from the West Antarctic sheet, basically the latest science documenting that the breakup is going much faster than even the latest science had predicted. About a year ago, Jim Hansen had put out a study predicting that as soon as 5 decades from now, in the 2060s basically, we could see not just 10, but 20, 30, and 40 feet of sea level rise if we didn't profoundly change course. And this is essentially what the new data that the NOAA administrator was referring to, that said, that basically advanced the timeline to say that by 2050 we could see 9 feet of sea level, which means, you know, half of Manhattan will be underwater. It also means that we will lose all coastal cities and ports. So if you're worried about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, no worries. There will be no maritime trade. There will be no ports from which trade will take place. But unfortunately, that means no population centers either. And if we think we have trouble right now with 40 million refugees, I think it is now, the global refugee count related to poverty and war and climate change, it's about 40 million. we're talking hundreds of millions of refugees at a minimum. So this is not a sustainable hit. This is not something we will be able to survive. And I know that there are some nuclear power plants that are actually at sea level, which will be flooded, and we are looking at about two dozen or so Fukushimas. There's one near my house, Pilgrim Power Plant, and I went to look up what's its sea level elevation. Well, it's at zero. Nuclear power plants need a lot of cooling. That's why they're at zero sea level elevation. And you know, in order to decommission a nuclear power plant, you have to start way in advance. So that's one other thing we have to start right now, is decommissioning our nuclear plants as well as decommissioning our fossil fuel plants. So this is stuff that we need to do now. We can't put this off. This is immediate, and it's really important, I think, for us to be just clear about what the terms of the crisis are. One other little factoid I want to convey, and this came out just last week also, a review of what our global levels of CO2 and methane are right now. So the rise in CO2 level, that is the parts per million of carbon dioxide, is actually accelerating. It used to be going up by about 1.5 or 2 parts per million per year. Now we've hit a new all-time record. It's now going up by 3 parts per million per year. And here's what is, I think, most concerning of all. Methane levels have, the increase in methane levels has basically doubled as well. So in other words, the rise in methane has now gone up 100% over the baseline of the last many years, which could just be, variation, but it's not likely to be because, you know, we are fracking up a storm right now, and we know that fracking leaks methane. The other very worrisome possibility is that this rise in methane represents an accelerated meltdown now of the permafrost under the oceans and in the Arctic. That is basically the carbon bomb of nightmare proportions because, as you may know, methane in the short term is about 70 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So this so-called methane bomb, represented by the melting of the frozen methane in the so-called permafrost, is extremely dangerous. So all these are reasons why this is not something that should be left up to private companies who not only have a stake and a conflict of interest about carbon reductions, but they're legally obliged to make greatest profit on their dollar. So I think this underscores that it's essential that we move to the kinds of systems you'll be hearing us talk about today for actually managing our energy resources as a public good. And I'll just say a quick word about the Green New Deal, which is our proposal for how we do this. In the 1930s, we recognized that we had an economic emergency. Well, for most people, we still have that economic emergency. And we have on top of that a climate emergency. So it turns out you can solve them both together through a New Deal type program, but in this case it's green, in order to transition our energy, our food system to a sustainable, locally based and healthy food system, as well as our transportation, which is a major source of carbon emissions, moving to a largely public transportation system, including safe bike paths and safe sidewalks so that we can include muscle power transportation that dovetails and with our public transit, as well as ecosystem restoration as part of restoring critical infrastructure. If you do this, you save so much money by the health improvements from preventing pollution that it essentially pays for itself just in terms of those health benefits. And this is well documented in reports put out by Mark Jacobson from Stanford. And I'll mention also the country of Cuba was the living evidence of this when their oil pipeline went down in the early 1990s. Their death rates, because they had no pollution, they moved to a healthy, largely plant-based organic food system, overnight, and they used muscle powered and public transit. Their death rates from diabetes went down 50% almost overnight, and their death rates from heart attacks and strokes went down about 30%. So for us, we spend $3 trillion a year, not on a healthcare system, on a sick care system, because corporate America is very busy making us sick through those systems. By transforming them rapidly, we can basically pay the cost of transition. In addition, a Green New Deal, besides reviving the economy, turning the tide on climate change, it also makes wars for oil obsolete and enables us to basically massively cut our military budget, which is largely about securing fossil fuel and energy resources and their routes of transportation. And in doing that, we can also plug back in another $500 billion into making this transition and lead the way to demilitarizing all of our budgets, not just the US, but Russia and China, whose economies are also very much hurting and who are also really struggling with the consequences of climate change right now. So this is a win-win-win for all of us. All we need is the courage of our convictions to insist that we will accept nothing less than a world in which we can survive and thrive. Thank you.
You're listening to Notes from the Left Forum, Dr. Jill Stein on climate justice. Following her talk, a Q&A from audience members. Mark Dunley with the Green Education and Legal Fund restates the questions.
Okay, so I heard three questions. The first had to do with sort of the role of non-governmental organizations and the big green groups and the concern that they're not getting called out enough for their sort of relationships with the status quo. The second was the need to how do we incentivize sort of the manufacturing industry to make it competitive, attractive for engineers and industrial designers. And third, I've been coming to Left Forum for 20 years and nothing ever changes. And when are we going to stand up to the issue of the lesser two evils in elections and also the whole role of the military, including energy use?
Well, in terms of calling out Big Green,
Howie Hawkins, chair of New York State's Green Party.
I agree. We need to do more of that. You know, I've tried to do it. One thing I'll say about Sierra Club is that they do elect their boards. And we've had Green Party members who played a big role in getting New York Atlantic chapter to change their position on fracking. It's kind of like being in a union. I'm a Teamster. And I tell you, it's harder to fight the officer machine than it is the Democrats, because at least you get a voter list in a public election. In a union election, you get one mail-in, at least in the Teamsters, to the opposition, but you never see the list. So you got to build your own list at the plant gate. It's very labor-intensive. Sierra Club, I'm not sure, but I'm not a member. I quit when David Brower quit and formed Friends of the Earth back in, 1970. I came up in California. But I think, the critique of Big Green, David Brower had that down. So I agree. We need to speak out more on that. In terms of, I think this brother was asking, how do we get the technicians, the engineers, to work for us instead of the capitalists, basically? And I think, we're not going to give them the option of working for Exxon because we want to take them over. I also think the intrinsic motivation of, using the skills you've learned to do good for people. I mean, a lot of engineers and technicians have that. It's been my experience. I mean, my argument in New York, occasionally it'll come up and say, Cuomo's, like Mark said, Cuomo's the best guy we got. Don't be so hard on him. I'm running against him for governor. But why? Don't be so hard on him. He's the best we got. It's like, these guys are happy they got some work to do something for renewable energy, as limited as it is. But that's my answer to you, is that we have a public energy system. The technicians that want to do the job and make a contribution, they'll have plenty of opportunity too. And, we may not pay them outside salaries, but we'll pay them a good living. That's something that has to be negotiated. I don't mind if they organize, professionals. Like, we got teachers, we got nurses, why not engineers? We got to change Taft-Hartley for that. That gets into the third-party politics. And, what Linda said, I think the most important thing she said was, y'all got to start running for office. We got a Green Party line. You're smarter than the people we got in office. You know, don't rely on other people to do it. You got to step up and get your friends to get organized.
Leonard Rodberg is professor and chair of urban studies at Queens College of the City University of New York.
Thanks for the questions. On the big greens, I think we need a bit more of an analytical approach than just sort of say, follow the money arguments. I'm not against that. I think if you can point to fossil fuel companies giving big greens money and influencing their approach, that's a valid thing. But I think the bigger question for me is neoliberal market-based ideas have been hegemonic for 30 years on a lot of people in the liberal establishment, and even at the rank and file level, the grassroots activists believe in startup solar and, you know, green entrepreneurship. They went along with that, and that's, I think, been the problem. And it's, in many ways, it's a problem of the left that we haven't been able to articulate. Or we're only just beginning in the last few years to articulate a programmatic response to this approach. We talk about justice, we talk about rights, but we don't talk about how the hell are we going to do this. And I think that's so the big greens, I also feel, have recalibrated on the bridge fuel question. NRDC and Sierra Club, in my assessment, have made statements in the 2-3 years ago now, saying that they've reconsidered their approach to shale gas, for example, and they see the data around methane leakage to be serious enough to say that we can no longer treat gas as a bridge fuel. Now, that's not true of all the big greens. Environmental Defense, I believe, still stick to that line, but one or two of them, I think, have recalibrated their position on that. On the question of the technical questions that the brother in the second row raised, and this is something Darshan raised at the meeting yesterday, is I believe we need, you know, we had Homeland Security that was set up within weeks after 9/11. Of course, it was pre-planned, as was the operation itself, I would say. So the pre-planning of the Department of Homeland Security was a $52 billion project by the US state. Why can't we have a renewable energy administration? One of its jobs could be to go into the universities and high schools and say, we want you to be part of this great societal transition. There are many challenges of a technical and scientific nature, and we need all minds on deck to address that. Do something important with your life. Join us in this effort, sign the dotted line here. And I think we would get a generation of young, smart people gravitating towards the sciences, because there are technical challenges in going from fossil fuels to full renewables. It's not as easy as Marc Jacobson said, in my view. 100% renewable power by 2030, 2040 is basically embedded with very serious technical challenges that they can be overcome, but it's going to take a lot of scientific input and skill and expertise to come into that struggle. So I think that would be my answer to that question.
Jill Stein.
I want to speak to the lesser evil thing, because at the end of the day, it is what often stays our hands. And, you know, I think a lot of progressive, a lot of people who think of themselves as left, want to do the right thing, and then they get frightened. And there are fear campaigns out there in order to make you frightened. So we wind up going backwards instead of going forwards, and we redefine progress as not backsliding as quickly as we might. And we can see where that's leading us. So I think it's really important to examine the concept of the lesser evil. And this whole politics of fear that tells you you have to vote against what you're afraid of instead of for what you believe in. And the bottom line is that this politics of fear, if you look at the track record here, because this strategy has been out there for a while, to vote, you know, against your fear, it has a track record. What is that track record? The politics of fear has delivered everything we were afraid of. All the reasons that you were told you had to vote for the lesser evil because you didn't want the massive bailouts of Wall Street and the offshoring of our jobs and the meltdown of our climate. And by the way, all of the above turned out to be drill, baby, drill on steroids. If you actually look at the massive escalation of fossil fuels that took place under the friendly face of all of the above, the massive expansion of our endless wars, the attack on our civil liberties, on immigrant rights, et cetera, all those reasons you were told you had to vote for the lesser evil is exactly what we've gotten. Because at the end of the day, silence is not a political strategy. Democracy does not exist in a vacuum. It needs values and it needs visions. It needs a moral compass. Right now, we have a system in which everybody's busy voting against what their greatest fear is. A CNN poll came out last week showing that the majority, it's like 57% of Trump voters, are not really supporting him. They're just against Hillary Clinton. And a majority of Hillary Clinton's supporters are not really for her. They're just afraid of Donald Trump. So, you know, this is a moral vacuum. We are lost in a storm for lack of a moral compass. It makes the point. Let me also just mention that if you look at the number of young people who are locked in debt, and I mention this because there is a secret weapon right now for the left, for an agenda of justice. 43 million young people who are locked in debt, who have no future for getting out of student debt or having the jobs that enable them to do that. And there's only one candidate on the ballot who will abolish that debt like we did for Wall Street. So if young people actually learn that they can come out and abolish their debt, that is a plurality of the vote right there. So my point is, don't accept the propaganda, the very self-serving propaganda of the political elite that will tell you you are powerless. In the words of Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. We actually have it. There are many scenarios by which a coalition for justice could prevail right now with the stroke of a pen. Not to mention that this whole concept of taking votes away could be rendered obsolete through a simple voting reform that could be passed right now at the state level by state legislatures called ranked choice voting, which makes clear that if your first choice loses, your vote is automatically reassigned to your second choice. So this is simply a fear campaign in order to lock people in to voting for what they don't support. Fear should be taken out of democracy. We should be able to go to the polls and vote for what it is that we want and restore our moral compass and regain our future. This is within our hands the minute we stand up with the courage of our convictions.
I'll respond to the jobs question the brother has in the third row.
Sean Sweeney is with Trade Unions for Energy Democracy.
According to the American Petroleum Institute, they sustain 2.1 million jobs in the United States. If you look at the actual report that they produce annually, you'll find out some important facts. One is that almost a million of those jobs are forecourt attendants. These are people who pump gas. But if you look at the data coming from the industry, the people, the consortia of that represents forecourt attendance, such a thing does exist, only about 30% of their profits come from selling gasoline. The rest comes from cigarettes, chewing gum, toilet roll, coffee. In other words, this is the new market model because of the margins of profit are so low selling gasoline in the United States that they literally have to become corner stores. So for the industry to claim that they're sustaining, technically yes, they're sustaining these 900,000 jobs is, I think, misleading. But, you know, fossil fuels is still a big employer. But it's not, when you also look, the other point I would make is the coal industry is about 170,000 workers, most of them not in coal mining, but in coal transportation and utilities, or coal-fired power stations, I should say. Now, of that number, the interesting point is the United States mined, and that's a misnomer because it's actually blasted, more coal in 2012 than it did in 1945. And in 1945, there were 320,000 unionized miners in the United States. Today, there are 8,000 unionized miners in the United States and about 75,000 working miners, the majority of which now are in Wyoming and Montana, blasting up mountains and kicking up methane into the atmosphere. That's before the coal is burned. So a few little facts on the jobs. I can give you more if you need it.
I'll say a quick word also about jobs.
The data coming out of Western Mass, the economic institute there, was that for every dollar put into fossil fuels, you create three times as many jobs per dollar put into renewable energy and conservation. Same is true for military jobs, which are high cost, sort of capital intensive, that transitioning that system as well creates far more jobs. And I think it's important to step back and sort of see the forest through the trees here when we think about where the money goes, where our resources are spent, because the health costs of these toxic industries, which are not only toxic and deadly to workers, but also to communities and to ecosystems in the planet, the cost is so great that the costs of the energy transition and the economic transition are very small compared to the short-term health benefits. So it's important to think outside of the usual box in terms of what we can actually do here, because it's $1 trillion a year we spend on the military, which endangers us, doesn't make us safer, and it's $3 trillion a year that we spend on the sick care system between public, private, business costs. We're spending an enormous amount of money treating chronic diseases that are related to the pollution of the fossil fuel system, the passive transportation built into our current systems that do not allow us to use muscle power to get places and to transit hubs, and to a very toxic food system. And I don't mean only toxic chemically, but also toxic nutritionally, because the industrial food system takes out good nutrition and it puts in bad things like hormones and antibiotics, and totally changes the nutritional profile of animals that are raised in confinement and fed grain, which is an extremely unnatural thing to do. So it's really important to zoom out and see the big picture of how much money we gain. One last point I want to make is that we are now spending $1 trillion engaging in a new nuclear arms race, which has been initiated by the United States. We were the ones to first pull out of the nuclear disarmament treaties, to pull out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which is sort of the basic core of nuclear disarmament. And instead, we are engaging now in a $1 trillion budget to create a whole new generation of nuclear weapons and modes of delivery, which will in turn engage greater weapons production from Russia and probably China as well. There will be no end to this. So we are now on a trajectory of assured mutual destruction, whether you're looking at nuclear weapons or climate, et cetera. But on the other hand, we have another choice, which is a Green New Deal, including an office of renewable energy and an office of full employment. All the wonderful, great ideas that are here, we're hearing in this room today, you know, should not be sort of hung out to dry and neutralized and disarmed by the industries that are running the show here. If democracy existed, if we put ourselves in control by asserting the power that we already have, these ideas would not just be hypotheticals. We would be undertaking them with the full power of the resources that we actually have.
You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum with Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein, chair of the New York State Green Party, Howie Hawkins, Mark Dunley with the Green Education and Legal Fund, Professor Leonard Rodberg, chair of Urban Studies at Queens College, and Sean Sweeney with Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, recorded on May 22, 2016. Rebellion, Organizing Our Power was the theme of this year's Left Forum. Notes from the Left Forum was produced at WBAI News in New York by Linda Perry, with thanks to Seth Adler and Associates at the Left Forum. Thanks for listening.